So, as I mentioned, we are going to have Michael Schlesinger. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences. He was at the Avoiding Catastrophic Climate Change conference in Exeter, England, a couple of weeks ago, and we'll have him up here in just a few minutes. So you're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. We're going to the top of the hour, and now I'm going to play a short piece of tape for you that I recorded about 9 hours ago from the commemorative event celebrating the enactment of the Kyoto Protocol. This was recorded live from Kyoto, Japan, very early this morning. We're going to hear from Wangari Muta Matai. She is a Kenyan woman who won the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize for her work with the Green Belt Movement, planting trees across Africa. And she spoke regarding the implementation of the Kyoto Protocol and sustainable development. And these are excerpts that I've made. And after we listen to this, we'll be back with Dr. Michael Schlesinger speaking about the Climate Stabilization Conference in Exeter a couple of weeks ago in Britain.
If the world invested more in the environment, sustainable development, good governance, and equitable distribution of resources, many of the conflicts in the world would be preempted. The concept of peace has to be expanded to include the environment. Today marks the end of a long process for the survival of all the species on the planet, including our own. It is also the beginning of an even more engaging phase when the treaty must be implemented. We must remain committed and focused. The biosphere needs the Kyoto Protocol, and we welcome its coming into force. We hope that we can rely on the group of the most industrialized countries, the G8, to continue to prioritize climate change. This also involves addressing the issues which make it difficult for poor countries to make their contributions to this agenda. These issues include the burden of international debts, trade barriers, and lack of adequate financial support to make the critical economic turn. Without addressing these issues, it will be difficult to realize the Millennium Development Goals and make poverty history. One of the questions that comes up often in the press is what I think about countries that have not ratified the protocol yet. What I say is that we should, at this time, be positive and look forward. We are here to mark the coming to force of the Treaty on the Climate Change, and we want to celebrate. We must remember that it is the actions of such individual citizens that will ensure the Kyoto Protocol yields fruits. Even if all the governments signed the treaty, but the citizens did not subscribe and take action, the treaty would show no impact. It is also some of these citizens who will continue to urge their governments to come along and join the rest of the world for the sake of life on our planet. They have enormous commitment and have taken personal steps to reduce overconsumption and emissions of greenhouse gases. We applaud them and urge them to continue. They are on board. Like them, we must believe in ourselves individually and collectively, and believe that we can make a difference. We must start with ourselves and continue taking those small personal steps to reduce the global rise in temperature. Together, we form a multitude, and we can bring about the desired change both locally and globally. Even though there is a general consensus that the issue of climate change is urgent, the movement towards action is always slow in coming. This is because the projected negative impact on the climate is slow, away from everyday occurrence, and therefore even disputable. It is also because many of us have become used to our lifestyle and are not easily persuaded to consume less and reduce greenhouse gases. Further, those of us who are rushing to catch up with the highly industrialized world are not willing to be persuaded to slow down. Ladies and gentlemen, the projected negative impact of climate change is also unfortunately likely to negatively impact the next generation.
And that was Wangari Mutu Maathai speaking very early this morning, local time, from Kyoto, Japan, at the commemorative event celebrating the enactment of the Kyoto Protocol, which took effect today. So some words from the actual event, always good to have. So we're going to round out this hour looking at issues related to the Kyoto Protocol and climate change more generally by speaking with Michael Schlesinger. He is a professor of atmospheric sciences and head of the Climate Research Group at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he also attended the Avoiding Catastrophic Climate Change conference that took place in Exeter in Britain a couple of weeks ago. Welcome to the airwaves, Michael.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. Now, first off, can you just tell us real briefly why this conference took place and what folks were hoping to get out of what took place?
The conference took place because the United Kingdom has the presidency of the G8 group of nations and the European Union, and Tony Blair is using that to attempt to get the United States on board to abate climate change. This meeting was held to look at, it's not catastrophic, it was called dangerous climate change, pretty close to the same thing, with the idea of trying to assess whether or not we are near dangerous climate change, and if so, what we should do about it.
Okay. Now, you were there as a researcher. You presented a paper looking at the risk of a collapse of the Atlantic thermohaline circulation. And for folks who've listened to the program for any length of time, that's probably not a new concept to you. The thermohaline circulation in the Atlantic is basically the reason that Europe is not as cold as it was about 500-600 years ago, or maybe it was 12 or 13,000 years ago. Anyway, it's the circulation current that brings warm water from the Gulf of Mexico and the southeastern U.S. across the Atlantic, up kind of over England and, I guess, up towards the North Sea. In your opinion, how much of a risk of a collapse of the Atlantic thermohaline circulation exists? And I assume that's dependent on where CO2 levels stabilize in the atmosphere.
Well, we looked at this following on a paper we published in Science last October, wherein we postulated that the fact that there is uncertainty is not a reason for doing nothing, but is in fact a reason for taking action. We can talk about that a little bit more. But when I was invited to give this talk at the conference, we followed on that science study to look at the risk of shutting down this Atlantic thermohaline circulation, which, as you see, said, keeps England and Europe warmer than it would otherwise be the case. And I was greatly surprised with our analysis. We found out that absent any climate policy, that is, if we just have business as usual into the future, that over the next 200 years, there's a 70% likelihood of shutting down that circulation.
Hmm. Was that new news to
folks
there? Oh, yes,
that was definitely new news.
Okay. What kind of...
In fact, this is the first analysis. In the past, people have speculated about the likelihood of this circulation shutting down, but no one has carried out an analysis, a quantitative analysis, before what we did. So the presentation I gave got a lot of attention.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask is, you know, if there's the chance that England in specific, where the meeting was held, and Europe in general, which is viewed globally as a leader on issues related to climate stabilization, if you know, they were to enter a sort of deep freeze period sometime in the next two centuries or have a 70% chance, I imagine they would have quite the response. Did you receive any substantive challenge to your data?
Well, let me try and correct one thing that you said here about a deep freeze. Mm-hmm. This circulation we know has shut down in the past. About 13,000 years ago, it shut down because the ice sheet on North America, which was melting, the meltwater, instead of going down the Mississippi, was shunted out the St. Lawrence, putting fresh water on the North Atlantic, making it less dense, and then this water didn't sink, and that shut down the circulation. And something like that happened 8,200 years ago as well. So we know it happened in the past. We're talking about the possibility of it happening in the future in a kind of ironic way. As we warm the planet, we put more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that increases the precipitation over the North Atlantic. And so, like the fresh water put on by the melting North American ice sheet, the fresh water put on the North Atlantic by the warming world basically shuts down this circulation. Now, when it happened in the past, there was no global warming, and so there was a net cooling. And in fact, in England, we know from beetles, not the Beatles, but beetles that are temperature sensitive, that the temperature dropped about 30 degrees Fahrenheit in a very short period of time when the circulation shut down. The world is different today. We don't have these ice sheets that we did then, located near Europe and England. And so if the circulation shuts down in the future due to increased greenhouse gases and global warming, we will probably not have a net cooling in England and in Europe, but just a diminished warming. But this is a circulation that does other things as well as transport heat. In fact, it transports a million billion watts of heat into the North Atlantic. And if we shut that down, this will have effects on fisheries, for example, which will impact human beings. So this is probably not an experiment, even though there will be no net cooling. This is probably not an experiment we want to carry out on our planet.
Now, I take it that the influx of fresh water that would contribute to this is a result of the melting Arctic as opposed to receding glaciation across a continent.
Well, we just don't know very well. The model simulations that have been made show an increase of this precipitation, as I mentioned, over the North Atlantic. That's water that comes from the atmosphere, which originally came from the tropics. These models don't yet include ice sheets in them. In fact, my research group, is planning to use our ice sheet model in our comprehensive climate model to exactly look at this important issue. There is evidence now that there has been fresh water added to the North Atlantic, so you have hit the nail on the head as to one of the key uncertainties. Basically, if you put no fresh water on the North Atlantic, then the circulation doesn't shut down, doesn't slow down. If you put on enough fresh water, as happened 13,000 years ago, you shut this circulation down, and so this is highly uncertain. In our study, we took this uncertainty into consideration. We took four quantities as being uncertain and assumed probability distributions for them, one of which is how much fresh water is added to the North Atlantic. And we made many, many simulations choosing different values of these uncertain quantities and took the average over those probability distributions of the outcome, and the result was that 70% likelihood of a shutdown over the next 200 years, which, as I said, was very surprising.
Now, as someone who doesn't do computer modeling, not a climate researcher, but listening closely to what you've said and having read the paper you presented in Exeter, if some water creates an effect, more water up to possibly some critical threshold where a result could reverse, more water further reducing the salinity of the ocean would seem logically to speed up whatever process is already underway. Does that make a certain amount of sense?
Yes and no.
Wow, I got both of them.
Well, you did get both of them, actually. Your reasoning works to a certain point, but this system we believe to be nonlinear, and so it has threshold or bifurcation points where it discontinuously changes from one regime to another regime.
Okay.
And we're not sure that the ocean has that, although we have the evidence that it shut down 13,000 years ago, so it suggests that it can do it in the future as well. But we don't know how close we are to that threshold.
Right, and that's
the uncertainty. And I do want to say something about the uncertainty. The current administration in the U.S. has made the argument that because there is uncertainty, we should do little or nothing about this problem until we reduce the uncertainty. And this takes the point of view that uncertainty with further research does reduce in the future. But the evidence recently is just exactly the opposite. The U.S. National Research Council in 1979 published a report where they estimated the climate sensitivity, that's how much the global warming could double the pre-industrial CO2 amount, and they said the most likely value is 3 degrees Celsius with a probable error of plus and minus 1.5 degrees Celsius. And to convert that into Fahrenheit, just multiply those numbers by 2. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, took that to mean that the range was 1.5 to 4.5, and there was zero likelihood that it existed outside that. But the truest way of interpreting that is that there's only 50% likelihood that it's between 1.5 and 4.5, and 50% outside that. In the last 6 years, research by my group and others using the observed temperature record of the last 150 years have shown that that range, the 90% likelihood range, runs from about 1 degree out to 9 degrees. And 2 weeks ago, a group in the UK published a paper from climateprediction.net that said they could not rule out a value as large as 11 degrees. That's 22 degrees Fahrenheit. My point is, over the last 26 years of continuing research, uncertainty has increased, not decreased. And if you wait at such a time as the uncertainty is diminished, because of the nature of the climate system on the Earth, because this is the only planet that has an ocean which can transport heat away from the surface downward, thereby reducing the warming compared to what it would be on a planet with no ocean, if you wait, you foreclose options that are presently open. We studied this in our science paper and therefore argued that uncertainty was the reason for taking action now by taking out basically low-cost insurance as a hedge against an uncertain climate future. And this study that I presented in Exeter 2 or so weeks ago followed on looking at this abrupt climate change, this collapse of the Atlantic thermohaline circulation. And again, it finds that by taking a hedge, by taking action now, we can reduce the likelihood of a shutdown considerably, basically down to a 1 in 4 likelihood, or 25%, but those odds are still not very good. One would probably like to make it a 1 in 20 occurrence. That is a 5% level. So that means even by taking a hedge of near-term tax now on carbon, we can reduce the odds, but we can't probably reduce them enough, and that means there are other measures that have to be taken to probably remove the CO2 from the atmosphere that we have been putting in for the last 150 or so years.
And I just want to reiterate to folks that the fact that uncertainty, as you said, is increasing the more we study, that also parallels with we know a lot more. I mean, in some cases, the more you know, the more uncertainty there is because you have access to information and ways of approaching questions that you just didn't think about before because, well, that, you know, that's not possible.
Well, then, that's true.
Yeah.
And again, as I said, because the Earth's climate system is special, it has this thermal inertia. At the moment, we've had a 7/10 of a degree Celsius warming since pre-industrial times. If we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere right now, completely today, the temperature will warm up again by another 7/10 of a degree Celsius, and that'll take a few hundred years, and sea level will continue to rise for almost 1,000 years after we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere. That puts a different perspective on this problem from a case where we have an all-land planet. So we're in a kind of unique situation. If we wait long enough to diminish the uncertainty within whatever bounds you say you want, you may have foreclosed so many options that it will be less costly to take a near-term hedge, low-cost, if you like, climate insurance. I bet everybody in your audience over a certain age that has children has life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really likes to pay the premium, myself included. You don't know exactly when you're going to die, but the uncertainty of your future death is so potentially harmful to your family that you take out this low-cost hedge against this uncertain future, and that's exactly what we should be doing now as well for the climate situation.
Now, we got about a minute or so left here. I'm just curious for your perspective on response to that study published a couple weeks ago in Nature that said, we're not necessarily looking at 1 to 7 or 1 to 9 degrees. We're looking at possibly 11 degrees. Was that as big of news as, say, your study showing there's a chance, 70% chance in the next two centuries that the thermohaline circulation would shut down?
I think they're on a par. I was, frankly speaking, a little bit concerned that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was trying to reduce the apparent uncertainty, because that's what some policymakers say they need in order to take action. There was a meeting last May in Ireland where I got this impression, and in fact one of the authors of this paper that said 11 degrees gave me that impression, and so our research showed that it could be as large as 9 degrees or 9.3 degrees. That's from the observed temperatures. This new study is from a model simulation. So I felt that this was the best outcome relative to what I and other groups have done using the instrumental temperature observations.
All right, and we're actually just going to have to leave it there. My guest this second half of the hour has been Michael Schlesinger. He's a atmospheric sciences professor and head of the climate research group at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he attended the Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change conference in Exeter, Britain, a couple of weeks ago. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Michael.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Take care. If you have any comments or questions about this program, any other program you've heard, feel free to send me an email at kboo@riseup.net.